Spring Fest is heating up at Lowe's, and for a limited time, we have the extra big deals you need to impress guests. Get your outdoor space ready and save $50 on the select Kobalt 24-volt blower kit, now $79. Plus, save $80 on the Charbroil Performance 4-burner grill, now $199. It's springtime, and our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 4/13, while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. Made in collaboration with my good friends at the amazing charity Help Musicians. In this episode, we're joined by a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter with one of the biggest hits of the last decade under her belt. She was born in Bristol and she learned to play guitar playing along with Tracy Chapman. She was 14 when she signed her first record deal. She's worked with Kylie Minogue, James Blunt, Keith Urban. Toured Australia with the Welsh rugby team. At least that's what it says here. And let's not forget, she's very good friends with Ed Sheeran. Please welcome the wonderful Amy Wodge. Amy, welcome to this podcast. I never thought it would happen. Yet another bloody podcast for Help Musicians, in fact. How are you?
I'm very well and all the better for seeing and hearing you.
That's very kind. So when you were growing up at home, what was your room like?
Oh, my goodness. Do you know what? My mum was a complete clean freak and it used to absolutely drive me mad. And I am now my mother. So my children, I'm loath to tell you so that my kids will know that I'm just as bad as them. Organised chaos, but my mum would come in and try and reorganise my chaos so I wouldn't find anything. So probably not what people would have expected, quite minimalist and quite clean, but I don't think that would be my choice. When I was younger, it would have been a bit more chaotic than that.
Right. You know, when you're a young teenager, did you have like posters on the wall and sort of...
I did. Yeah, I did. My first like proper poster was a huge Queen is Dead, The Smiths poster, which I kind of wish I still had because it was so cool.
Yeah.
And then my first major crush was Michael Hutchins that I would kiss. I'm not going to lie.
What was it about Michael that you liked apart from his fantastic looks?
I mean, his fantastic looks, Chris. That was basically it. But it was the first gig I ever saw. I went to see the Kick Tour at age 11 in Birmingham NEC. I mean, what a gig to have seen. And it just I fell in love with them completely after that. I was asked by a friend, like the really cool kid in school asked me, and I think I lied and said, yeah, I'm a massive fan of INXS. And then promptly went home and like tried to find out about them. And then when I went, I was blown away. So yeah, it kind of stuck with me forever.
Did you have friends at school that turned you onto music?
I wouldn't say particularly. I think I didn't really understand why everybody else wasn't as obsessive as me. And I remember a music teacher, I went to a private all-girls school and we had a new music teacher called Mr. Marr who came into the school and he said one assembly, I'm going to put a school band together. I remember running from assembly to music block, you know, thinking in my head, everyone is going to be wanting to do this. And I was the only one. And then I had to kind of convince the other friends to do it with me. And my school were pretty instrumental, actually, in kind of getting me on the way they worked it out pretty quick that I loved writing songs. And so I was just that kid in assembly every day playing my own songs. I'm sure all the kids were like, ugh.
But there was nobody else in the school that you could buddy up with?
There was eventually. So my friend Claire, who inevitably joined the band with me, we ended up forming a band called Two of Mind when we were 15 and we got a record deal in Bristol. So there was someone eventually that was kind of, but she's a music teacher now. We're still very much in touch. Mm-hmm. But it was definitely me with the aspiration at the time to be a big pop star.
What sort of music were your parents listening to?
Dad was pretty influential on me growing up, and he still is. My dad has an encyclopedic knowledge of music. So my first kind of thing of actually realising what songwriting was when he put Goodbye Yellow Brick Road in my hand. And I met Elton mm-hmm. and told him that, you know, since I was 8, basically, as soon as I had that in my hands, it kind of changed the landscape of how I thought. And Dad had a really, and he still does, has got such a great music taste. And he's, you know, he's 77 now, and he says, have you heard this? He loves like the new Taylor Swift album, Folklore, and he'll message me. So he's been hugely important in my musical sort of, you know, like development.
That's quite amazing to have a very supportive father.
Yeah. I've just been very lucky. I was like an alien in my family because nobody was a musician, and my dad was a lawyer, and, you know, but they've always just been absolutely brilliant about my career. And I think they realized very quickly that it was the thing that made me tick. And so it was best to basically support me completely with it.
Which is great, because that probably meant that there was no other path for you.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've understood it more as I've grown up, but I mean, I still have ADHD now as an adult, but I think when I was younger, it was very much the thing that they harnessed. And I mean, it wasn't called ADHD back then, but they knew that to calm me down and put all of my angst into a song, they kind of worked it out pretty quick. And my mum used to say, go and write a song, you know, you're being difficult, go and write a song. And it used to really upset me, but she was so right. She was so right.
Did you ever write songs to piss them off?
Oh, yes, of course. Everyone always says, you know, that if you got on the wrong side of me, you ended up in a song.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the greatest get back, isn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely. It definitely is.
You know, your parents were supportive of you and you had ADHD. How did it sort of come out? You know, were you just very running around doing 100 different things?
I mean, I understand it a lot more now because I think as an adult, you understand like what makes you tick. It kind of lines a few things up. When I was younger, it was more to do with my energy levels. And I think girls are very different than boys. I wasn't particularly naughty, but I just had excessive energy and I didn't know what to do with it a lot of the time. And I think mum and dad, you know, when I was younger, it was just called hyperactive. So, you know, and I was always told I was going to grow out of it, which is rubbish.
Yeah.
But I think I'm just so lucky that I had the kind of parents that never tried to contain it. If anything, they just realized that in the right context, it could be used in a really good way. And that's essentially what they did. So my parents, you know, I mean, if you met them, bless them, then, you know, they're not rock and roll at all. But from the age of 14, I would be gigging in pubs, and my parents obviously had to take me because I was underage, and they would take me wherever, and they signed a record deal, obviously, you know, and they let me do all those things, probably in the full knowledge that it was probably better for me in mental health terms to let me do it.
So you're keen on spinning lots of plates?
Yeah, but a lot of break, Chris, but yes, I do spin plates.
Yeah, I live with a couple of Geminis, and they have ADHD, and the house is always upside down.
Yeah, there you go. It's like, it definitely presents in different ways. I'm strange. I'm so tidy. So some people kind of, they go the other way, but either extreme is pretty hard. It's, you know.
But it's a gift too. It's a real gift.
Yeah, I see it as that now, definitely.
Yeah, it is. What kind of songs were you writing in those early days? Who were you writing about?
I mean, who knows, really? I think the first album that I really decided I wanted to learn to play was the Tracy Chapman album. And I think once I had a guitar in my hand, things made a bit more sense. And so I just used to, and I still do it now, really, when I do songs for myself, it was just a way of diarising my life. So whatever was going on, it would end up in songs. And I look back on some of them now and think, oh, what was I really trying to say? I wrote this song about Nelson Mandela that won this school competition that made me kind of really lock in and think, oh, you know, maybe I can actually like, so I definitely went on a bit of a journey of trying to be all political, but I realized very quickly that was not what I was good at. So yeah, I've, you know, always really personal stuff and just my family, my friends. And I still do that now, really.
Did you have lots of ambitions? Did you sort of see where you wanted to go?
Yeah, I was hugely ambitious when I was younger to be an artist and, you know, really focused everything on that and then realised it was making me dreadfully unhappy. And so the best decision I ever made was at the age of 30 was to just move my whole career over to songwriting and just sort of keep the artist thing as kind of a hobby, really, and just not take that seriously. And it it definitely released something in me. And I kind of had enough signs from the gods. I did the right thing because the first person I met was Ed Sheeran. So it was like, maybe I've made the right choice. But yeah, I definitely wanted to be a big pop star when I was younger, and that changed.
So when the songwriter arrives, do you feel very grounded?
It's the only time that I feel really, really confident in who I am. It's one of those weird things that I'm a much braver person as a songwriter than I am as a human. And I think that probably even being a mum has worked in my favour, that it's all happened a bit later, because I tend to work with quite young people. And I've just lost that envy thing. You know, when you're younger, everyone's a threat. And now everyone that walks through my door is a bit of a gift. And if they're young, I'm like, oh, imagine what it must be like to be you with everything ahead of you. And I think it just inhabits a much more peaceful place for me, being a songwriter.
As a solo performer and as a solo songwriter, is that completely different from when you're writing for other people?
Completely different. It's just like a completely different headspace and lane. And I'm just saying what I want to say. And whereas the songwriting world for me is only about the other person. And it's just nice. It's nice to kind of separate them off. I did some shows this weekend for the first time in 2 years, and very low-key shows. And it just reminded me, this is can be fun now, because I'm not worried if there's a record company in the audience, or I'm not worried what people think of me. I'm just there and just expressing whatever I want to say. But they're definitely two different lanes.
And do people expect you to do the songs that you've had successfully covered in your set?
Do you know what? Sometimes, Chris, people leave after I've played Thinking Out Loud. I'm under no illusion that they're really there to hear the wafflings of a 45-year-old. So I do a big mix of like keeping faith, like some of my songs with other people, and then I just intersperse a few things that are me. But I have a home in Nashville now, and I love that kind of ethos of the songwriter showing who they, the songs they've done. And I get a real kick out of it. I really do.
So when you go up on stage and you're Amy, do you feel like that's home for you?
I was saying to my friend this weekend that it's a little bit of a meditation. Once I get over the, oh my God, I've got to go on stage. Once I get up there, it's like putting on pajamas or something where you just go, oh, this feels really nice. And because I don't take it too serious anymore, I definitely have a sense of just of it being much more peaceful than when I was younger and or worried about all those things. So I think, yeah, I think I'm much more myself now than I ever was.
What was the first song that you had covered?
I guess it was, Ed was my first sort of breakthrough. I met him when he was 17 and he came to Wales and we wrote 9 songs in 2 days, and 6 of them became the Songs I Wrote With Amy EP, which he released a few years later. So that was my first sort of thing of, you know, of actually experiencing what that was like, you know, and then it just built from there. Things happened. And it wasn't really until Thinking Out Loud that I really felt that, okay, now let's go. We're going to sort of really get there. But Ed was the first person, really.
So he strikes me as fluent as you.
We definitely have that sort of strange thing that we're both quite similar the way we write. And we were together last year and we did 11 songs in 3 days. We always just go, and it doesn't mean everything is amazing. I always say there's a moment when we kind of maybe hit gold. But he's a bit the same as me, that he doesn't overthink. He just lets it come and works it out that way. So I love writing with him. I really do.
So how does your day roll when you've got somebody that you're supposed to be writing a song with?
So it depends. I mean, at the moment, it's slightly different. I've spent the last 7 years doing 2 weeks every month in the US. So until last year, I wasn't home very much. And usually it is as simple as somebody getting in contact saying, we want Amy to come and write with our artist. And it can change, you know, on a daily basis. I do love when I get to do a body of work with somebody, because then you can really get to know them. And at the moment, with the pandemic and everything, I've essentially been working on Zoom, and my day starts either 5 or 7, because I'm pretty US led with what I do. So last night I sat in this hotel room and wrote a song at like 8 o'clock last night, and I don't have any instruments with me. I just made it work. I think it's half the reason why I love it so much, is it changes on a daily basis.
Are you quite strict?
I think I'm very, very driven. I think I am a very much a words person and I like to write about something. That doesn't mean it has to always be deep. I'm not one of these people that just goes for a vibe. And sometimes I feel like I'm a bit of a dinosaur now in some writing rooms because it's quite different now, the way people write it. But I'm pretty strict with how I work, you know, and I'm not a big believer in spending hours and hours on something. If it doesn't come quickly, and especially with Zoom, 2 or 3 hours, that's it. If it's not done there, it's not going to happen.
I always think good writers like yourself are like tailors. You know, they walk into the room with somebody like Kylie and they measure them up, find out how many buttons they want on their jackets and write the song so it fits. Is that how you feel?
Yeah, that's pretty spot on, you know, and with the sort of only caveat that they help me as well. You know, I think people always sort of say to me, how do you get inspired? And I say, oh, I don't have to be inspired. In the end, the person comes in, and my favorite sessions are when you talk and then they say something and it resonates. I think you've just got to become a bit of a word magpie, that something will just shine and you'll say, oh, I think that's what we write about today. And I think I've just learned to trust that. I think you see in younger writers, without being critical, I used to do the same thing. They come too prepared. So they come with a whole track or they come with a chorus. And that's great if somebody hasn't got anything to say, but I've not really met anyone yet who hasn't got something to say. You know, a lot of it is having the confidence to just say it'll happen. But it's very much about making it be theirs. I'm not interested in making it mine.
Sure. So do you do very much research before you meet somebody, or you just let it flow?
I'll always kind of listen to stuff. And I mean, you know, I'm in the fortunate position that I'm working with some people that I've listened to them, and I go in with all the wrong preconceptions probably. And I've got to be honest, Chris, you have like the conversations with the record label and they say, this is what we need. And then you talk to the artist and they say, no, that's not what we're going to do. So you can do preparation to a certain point, but in the end, I think it's just about a moment and seeing if you connect.
And are there people that you're completely nervous about working with?
Always in the beginning, and then you get over it. There are times when my manager literally has to forcibly push me through the door. I've had some like imposter syndrome absolutely up the, you know, wazoo. And I remember like a few times I was just going, I cannot do this. I cannot write for John Legend. And then I go in the room and he's charming. And I like to think I can kind of cope with any situation.
And is it your manager who finds all of these links?
Yeah. I mean, Fran, I have the most incredible manager, Fran O'Connor, who just is as ambitious as a manager as I am as a writer, which really helps. And she managed All Saints and Five back in the day, and she's been around forever doing, you know, stuff. And so she has such a good handle on, and she knows me, and is with the greatest will in the world. My publishers are brilliant. I'm with Warner Chappell, and of course they do a lot of sessions for me. But Fran really knows me and knows how to put a room together. And I'm very much a lyricist top liner. So she's pretty good at making the room work. And I'm one of those people that just turns up and doesn't understand how much work has gone into it. She does, like, I know she really works so hard.
As well as these chats with my musical friends, we've also been meeting musicians who've benefited from Help Musicians and whose careers have been saved and supported by this wonderful charity. Whether through financial support, mental health support, training, mentoring, or enhancing skill sets. Let's now meet one of those wonderful people.
I'm Mark Hegarty. I'm a singer-songwriter show creator based in Cardiff in South Wales. My band is Hegs in the Elements. We call it Celtic Americana music. There's a lot of Welsh gospel in there as well. In terms of influences, you know, right across the board, really, but in particular, I would say Bruce Springsteen, Hothouse Flowers, The Alarm, George Michael, Billy Joel, Elton John. All the songs have big choruses. I'll tell you when it all started. I saw INXS on the Tube. Must have been about 1985, and just thought, oh my word, they just got me. You know, a number of years on, I won't tell you how many years on, but I'm still as obsessed with music now as I was then. Certainly one thing I'm very proud of is a couple of years back, I started a charity called Inhale the Music with a friend of mine who has cystic fibrosis. And we played 24 concerts in 24 hospitals in 5 days across Wales. The finale for the tour was an event in Cardiff with a choir. And, you know, that was a bit of a moment for me. It took me about 3 days to actually sort of, you know, come down from what we actually achieved. My last year has been difficult, but my last year has actually been very colourful. My sole income, which was Music for Life performances, stopped overnight. No money whatsoever, you know, were coming in. However, I know with a lot of musicians, creatively, it's been great because the world stopped. And then, you know, I've got 3 days a week while I'm driving for Asda, which has been an eye-opener. And I've actually enjoyed it because I've met other musicians, I've met DJs, I've met teachers, I've met taxi drivers. And this being for a songwriter, I've gained a lot of new experiences. So help musicians, the hardship grants that they give me, whilst the grant money initially, you know, fed me and paid my rent, it helped me to continue with my recording and with these projects. So I wouldn't have been able to function, I wouldn't have been able to continue without the help from help musicians, and I'm eternally grateful to them. There are good people out there. I know the musical industry, sometimes you see there are sharks everywhere. We all talk about how important this industry is, and there are people within this industry who are supporting us, who recognize our worth and who are helping us.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. Once upon a time when I was signed to EMI, they said, would I like to go to Nashville because people want to write with you? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I went to Nashville, and, you know, if you haven't got the song done by like 11 o'clock or something, the game's up. But I found myself very nervous about working with people because lyrically, I was very sort of South London and I didn't really want to move from. So, for instance, I put ironing board in one of my lyrics and this guy said to me, I cannot sing ironing board in a song. So consequently, I never really got off the ground in Nashville. So do you manage to sort of shave your words to fit everybody's voice?
I mean, I like to try. I think that's the thing I'm borderline obsessional about, is I really love to flip between genres. And I love country music. I've always loved it. So it wasn't a massive sort of shift for me when I sort of lay my cards out and said that I had aspirations to go there. And it takes a minute. I think somebody gave me some amazing advice, and that was to go and just write with the writers for a few times, you know, get in with the writer community and learn. So that's what I did. And I bought my home there so they knew that I wasn't just coming for 5 minutes. I always say I go to Nashville for words and LA for sounds. And I think you definitely have to embrace a bit of the world, but actually probably now you'd find that they would be a bit more inclined to open the door to new things, because so many people are moving there because it's 0% tax, quite frankly. So all the Californians are like legging it to Nashville.
You're kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Like the tax for the Americans, I think it's like, yeah, there's definitely something to do with that. And so creatively, it's very much changed now. And, you know, the Kacey Musgraves camp is very different to the Keith Urban camp. And you can flip between genres. But I had a scenario with Keith where I wrote a song with the word fridge in. And he was like, what is a fridge? And he's Australian. And I was like, come on, a fridge? But yeah, so I promise you, I feel your pain every now and then. And then they'll say things. And I'll be like, I remember being in a session and somebody said, oh, he's swolled up. I said, I become more British in those moments. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no idea. But it's kind of fun. And I love the fact that a lot of the time you don't pick up an instrument until you've written the entire lyric from top down. And I just love the kind of intelligence that forces you to try and raise your game to. And I just love it. I miss it so much. I haven't been there for a year. I miss it.
Oh, my God, yeah. What early country music do you aspire to?
it was probably, like, in truth, more Americana right at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
You know, kind of Joni and James Taylor and all those things led me into that world. But it was a bit sort of later, you know, Kacey Musgraves and Brandi Clark and all these people. I remember kind of getting hold of those albums in my 30s and just saying, this is absolutely what I want to do. Later in life, those artists had a really profound effect on me. And then, you know, the fact that I ended up writing with them was mind-blowing, you know.
So Nashville is home as well as Wales.
Yeah, it feels like it. It definitely does.
So are there also people that you've met that you've written a song with and you wished you hadn't? You don't need to name names, but do you walk out of a session sometime and go, oh, my God, I'm not sure about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, but you've also just got to sort of know that you're giving the child up for adoption. You just have to let it go, you know. Oh. And it's that weird thing. You know that before you even, you know, start writing the song. And it's always wonderful when the stars align and you feel proud of something. But, you know, of course, there's going to be times when, you know, I've had a couple of things come out and I've gone, really? Like, I can't believe that made the cut. But, you know, you just roll with it and learn not to be too precious about it, really.
Some people that I've been lucky enough to work with, like Ollie Murs, for instance, as probably the most commercial bit of songwriting I've ever done.
Yeah.
He spent most of his time trying to learn dance routines for a TV show he was doing rather than concentrating on the song. And that really frustrated me.
Oh, I've been there. Somebody played golf through the whole session once, like, as in, you know, we're swinging, you know, and it doesn't really reassure you that you're actually, like, being listened to. But yeah, and I think the generation that we have of oh my God, my phone is ringing in the hotel room.
Hang on, give me
5 seconds.
It's probably Kylie.
Thank you, bye.
Sorry, Chris. Reception. What did you just ask me?
I can't remember now.
In the modern age as well, like, the whole thing of phones and distraction drives me crazy, because with the wrong person, you just know you're not getting any connection at all. And I've got a bit braver with that. I've just sort of said, right, well, I'm not going to waste my time if that person isn't going to be fully engaged.
I watched the Taylor Swift film, and she was constantly on the phone throughout the film. But younger people are, I guess.
My children are. And truth be told, I probably am as well in everyday life, but not in a writing room. In a writing room, I think let's honour the song and, you know, be present.
So as a writer, we are magpies as writers. We steal from each other, obviously. And sometimes when I can't get going, I will listen to the rhythm of a piece of music that I love, let's say a Bob Dylan song, like Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I'll take the meter of that lyric and I'll put my own words in it. Is that the kind of technique that you would use?
I mean, I think arguably it's in me anyway, because I'm the sum total of all the music that I listen to. And I don't necessarily think I'm referenced stuff, but I have listened to stuff in a room that I think it's probably there in me, that I'll probably lean on a cadence of Elton's on a certain thing, or pull a bit of the Beatles or Joni, or, you know, and I think you probably could hear it all the way through. I'd love to think I'm massively original, but truthfully, I think we're all a sum of our parts, you know, of what we've been influenced by.
What's the quickest song you've written?
Don't Hate Me, but Thinking Out Loud.
Yeah, of course. 20 minutes. I knew he was going to say that.
I know, 20 minutes. I mean, in terms of the inception, Ed had gone to the shower and I started singing When Your Legs Don't Work Like You Used To Before. And I heard this voice just sort of saying, what's that? And he started singing the chorus. And then we went out for dinner and came back and just smashed the song out, you know, in 20 minutes. And then he was convinced that it was a massive song. And I was like, I don't know. So, and the rest is history. But yeah, I mean, I'm pretty quick with Ed. Usually, but I think that's probably, yeah, that's the one that I can really say it was really quick.
But it sounds to me like you have a cutoff point too.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And honestly, if it doesn't really have a germ of an idea in the first 30 minutes, my ADHD will just be, well, that's it. I'm done.
Yeah.
I'll move on. I kind of trust my instinct with that, you know.
So what has been like so far anyway, and I'm sure there'll be many, but like a really high point where you can wake up in the morning and go, I don't believe that happened?
I mean, Chris, there's been a lot, and I'm really glad that I'm, as you know, 8 years sober, and I've done it all sober, so I remember everything. And
brilliant.
And, yeah, which is cool, and I'm really glad that I can say that, because it's all been HD, and I remember so many things. But there are moments where I honestly just go, I don't know how I've wangled myself up here. 2 years ago, I was on Mystique for Jonas Brothers, and there was like 10 of us on this island. And I went for dinner, and we all had to sing our hits. And at the end of the table, Brian Adams had joined us, and he was singing like, everything I do it for you. And I just sat there and was like, I live in Pontypridd. What the hell is, what is going on? And I think those moments, like my friends, all my Welsh friends are like, it's not a job, Wodge, you're not doing a job. So I think that has been pretty tremendous. And I can't not say that the Grammy win wasn't.
Of course.
You know, it was amazing. And, you know, it's a very precious life memory.
And was there a point where you just went, you know what? I've had it with this, but this is like, you know, when you feel really low and you feel like, I don't think I can make this happen.
Yes. I mean, the trip to write Thinking Out Loud, which I didn't know was the trip because I was just going up to see Ed. We had so little money that Al had to give me like 3 credit cards so that we could like put the petrol across like 3 cards. But I never thought I'm going to quit. And more to the point, my husband never said to me, can you please just get a job? Like, what are you doing? But yes, I mean, really low points, you know, particularly as an artist, like not getting Radio 2 playlist and things that broke me at the time. But I actually know that every last one of them was quite fundamental to kind of the journey. So I don't really, and I mean, and even now there are times when I'll be completely honest where being successful isn't necessarily a jacket I wear with ease, because it's kind of, for starters, I think someone's coming to take it away. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I don't think I will do the pop drive forever. I'm very much moving into a bit of a musical theatre space that I think my older life will be, and I'm quite happy with that.
I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you about that, because I think we all get to a stage where we've popped out, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we want to move on, and our audience want to move on too. I was very inspired when I went to see Jamie the musical. Yeah. It gave me hope that pop music could be on the stage.
Definitely. I think we're living in a beautiful era where songs on film and, you know, people just bursting into song, nobody questions it. And my children are so into that, that I'm kind of around it a lot. And I feel I'm in the middle of a sort of a musical with Adam Lambert that's, you know, hopefully going to be a Broadway thing. And I'm also writing another musical. And I feel that probably is where my heart is going to go. And I would love to think I will always be, you know, I always say to Diane Warren, I want to be you when I'm older. I want to have a llama farm. People come to me for like big ballads. And I don't want to try and be something I'm not. And there are times, I mean, already where I'm going in rooms with young kids and I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't know this world anymore, and nor should I. And, you know, so I definitely feel that it will change. It will evolve.
Musical theatre is a different focusing point, isn't it? You really have to spend a lot more time. You just can't let the song jump out. You've got to work on it.
Exactly.
You've got to carry the story.
There you go. But you have this, inevitably, this amazing co-writer, which is the script. Mm. So you don't have to kind of, essentially, you've always got this thing to work towards. Whereas, you know, when you inhabit a space where you're just trying to write a hit, well, if we knew how to do that, we'd have all done it over and over again. You have, Chris, but you know, I think it feels like a safer space because you know when you've got it right and you know when you've got it wrong. And I really enjoy the fact that that's how you can do it.
Have you studied anybody in the musical theatre world? Have you listened?
Well, I trained, people don't know, but I trained as an actor. So I went to drama school for 3 years when I was in my early 20s. And so it's kind of a going back to a bit of my roots. I'm obsessed with Sondheim and obsessed really with anything that captures people, because I want to know why it captured them. I want to understand the thing. And I've worked a fair amount with Anthony Ramos, who was in Hamilton, and he's in the heights at the moment. I think Lynn has just he's transformed what musical theatre can be, because it can sound like anything if you're brave enough to try.
Wow, I'm so pleased that you're moving into it. Yet another musical that I can go and see and cry at.
I hope so, Chris. I hope it'll be tears of joy, not like because it's so bad. What she does.
Oh, no. Help Musicians is a charity that's been going for 100 years now. And in the last year, they've doled out over £17 million
wow.
to songwriters and composers and musicians. And I've met quite a few of them in the last year. And the empathy is extraordinary. Do you feel there's any empathy in the music industry?
God, what a question. It needs to change. I find one of the hardest things about my job is meeting so many broken souls that you know have been signed for all the breaks, but nobody necessarily looks after them. And I wish that had changed, you know, it's not that long ago with, you know, Amy Winehouse. And I think our industry, unfortunately, is built on trauma, because all of us tend to create, you know, from painful spaces. And, you know, the nature of being an artist is a very complex one. And I've never met an uncomplicated artist yet. And time again, I see people going down the same road that, you know, I've seen again and again. And I heard the other day that Universal are paying for anybody who wants it to have therapy, which I think is brilliant. And I think if there could be an understanding that the two things should go hand in hand. And then I think for young writers, that's a whole other thing, because it's so hard now to actually even just exist in the songwriting world without a massive hit. And so, you know, I think a lot more can still be done, a lot more.
A lot of the songwriters I've been working with for the last year on Zoom, you know, their quip is, well, if only Spotify would pay me a little bit more and credit me for the work that I do.
That's it, Chris. That's just it.
It's because that's the only shop window they've got. Whereas when I was a kid, there were loads, so many different shop windows for me to put my records in.
Yeah, I look after a young writer called Alex Stacey, and watching him, you know, maybe have 200 million streams of a song and literally have made nothing. It's absolutely galling. And we live in a world now where streaming is so big and radio is so much less. You know, and I spoke to, you know, a music exec the other day, because we were talking about, you know, us wanting points and us wanting all these, you know, extra things. And he said, you know, it's so hard to set that precedent. I said, I get it. But you do realize if you just sorted out the Spotify thing, this would all be fine. This would just go away, because it's just pretty awful. And unfortunately, people, it's so short-sighted, because the younger songwriters that are going to be the next Egg Whites and, you know, Steve Max are not going to be there, because they will not be able to survive. That is the fact. You know, I like to think that we're going to get there. I think people like Merck are on our side, and we're pushing to try and change the game and level up the landscape, but we'll see.
What do you think of Merck's company?
I think if it's in the real sense of what I've heard and what he said, I think it could be amazing, because I think he's essentially going to build a world where there's more value to the song. And frankly, the more songs he accumulates, then hopefully, you know, with Spotify and things, he can exert a bit of power and say, well, you can't have these songs if you don't pay people properly. That's what I hope.
Yeah.
I hope.
Well, his company, Hypnosis, they buy up stock. They buy up songwriters' stock. And what I liked about the conversation I had with him was that he is into song management.
Yes.
And publishers, as good as they are, they have millions of songs and they can't possibly manage all of those songs. I'm with Warner Chappell too, and I don't think I've had one phone call in 3 years. Whereas I do believe that someone like Ted Cockle or Merck would call me and say, you know what, that song, Pulling Muscles from Michelle, I think I can get it in a film.
Yeah.
And that's what songwriters need. They need that leg up.
Yeah, you're so right. And you just need, because, yeah, there are millions and millions of songs. And it stands to reason that if you're a big writer, maybe the sun will shine on those songs more. But the gems that are being lost, new writers, and, you know, and it's just about time that more value was placed on the song, you know.
At the end of the day, when things are, when your chips are down, who do you lean on?
I mean, my family, obviously, you know, my husband is the absolute unsung hero in this whole thing. None of anything would have happened if I hadn't had Al. And he remains this person, you know, just go do your thing. And then raising two girls, you know, and it being a slightly odd way around that mummy's away working, he's incredible about that and says to the girls all the time, you know, mummy is the person that's doing this. And as a result, I hope that I'm going to raise two strong, independent women who don't hate me for being away all the time. But yeah, I mean, and he's pretty spectacular, Chris. And, you know, and I wouldn't be here. And he has to cope with the, you know, he said to me the other day, which Amy's coming home this weekend? And I think that's basically our lives. But I hope to, I did say to him the other day, has it been worth it? He was like, of course it has. Yeah, bless him. But we're 20 years married this year. And
congratulations. That's amazing.
And he's pretty brilliant.
That's pretty hard in this world, in the music world. Yeah. To keep a relationship together, because I find sometimes when the songwriter appears in my shed, my wife says, well, what are you doing? And you look like you're just looking out the window. And I said, well, I am, but I'm looking for inspiration. I'm not a coal miner. I'm not down a pit, you know. I'm looking for my imagination. Do you ever get that?
Obviously, and the worst thing is with the pandemic is they've actually got to see what it is we do. For the last 7 years, I've managed to create the illusion that I'm grafting, and then they're like, because they hear the hoots of laughter coming from my studio. And but yeah, I mean, there must have been times when Alan's like, you know, doing the school run and I'm phoning from LA or Mustique particularly, and but he's pretty brilliant about it, and he's an actor, so I guess he understands some of it, you know. He definitely does.
Amy, thank you so much for being on this podcast with me. It's a real treat. I love you so much. Thank you.
I love you too. And we have to get together, Chris. We really do.
Keep coming back, as they say.
Absolutely. Lots of love.
Lots of love. Bye.
Bye.
I really enjoyed speaking to Amy. She's got an engaging personality and she really loves what she does. And on top of it, she's brilliant at it. And like me, she finds mobile phones a bit of a distraction, especially when you're trying to write songs and they keep buzzing. Unless it's a call from Taylor Swift, of course. I'm green with envy that she's written with Kylie Minogue. That's a big dream of mine, in case you didn't know. And of course, working with Ed Sheeran, that must be amazing too. We do have some things in common, of course, as songwriters, except for the fact that she's got a house in Nashville and I don't. But if I work harder and sharpen my pencil, perhaps I will. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode, and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.